You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the December 2020 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of The Long Way Home by Sandy Tan. Back in China, Zhao was the outcast, the weirdo, obsessed with the Mongolian plains. At boarding school, she was the kid in the library. Now that she's part of the conformist film industry, as she puts it, I love being reminded that there are other ways to live. While she's too busy finishing up Eternals to plan a new project, she hopes to replicate her gutsy system of making a smaller and a bigger movie in tandem, because each movie keeps the other in check. She names Alfonso Cuarón as the director with the kind of range she aspires to. Do I want to go back and make a film with even less budget than the writer? 100% if the right story presents itself. Would she make a movie set in China? Sure, if the right story came along. Her parents, whom she calls her best friends, still live in Beijing, as does the 98-year-old grandmother she's very fond of. They keep in touch via WeChat. As an only child, Zhao is thankful that, unlike many Chinese of her generation, she wasn't spoiled by them. But she feels the weight of their expectations on another matter. She went back and forth about whether I should refer to Richards as her boyfriend, partner, or life partner. One day before my deadline, she decided on partner, but not life partner. One less false hope for my parents to think they'll get their grandkids soon. For now, work takes precedence. During a break from shooting Eternals in London, Zhao went up to Edinburgh to visit the locations that inspired Harry Potter. Beyond that, she hasn't allowed herself a vacation. When you look at her calendar and stuff, the writing is so minute that you need a magnifying glass, says Richards. Every hour of the day is planned. I'm afraid of wasting other people's time and money, Zhao admits. That's a Chinese thing. I don't like to owe people things. After a bit, she refines that thought. Maybe I need to find a balance, to have a bit of a life. But I'm in this mindset where I'm afraid to disappoint people. Then she laughs this off, knowing how good Chinese daughter she sounds. The more people trust me and say, do what you want, the more I'm staying up at night. Thank you. The Art of Living. Matthew McConaughey was 23 years old and filming his first movie, Dazed and Confused, when he was blindsided by the death of his father. In an excerpt from the new oral history, All Right, the actor, his friends, and the cast and crew remember the devastating days that birthed a star, by Melissa Mayers, with opening photograph by Herb Ritz. Lone Star, the actor in a photo from his first Vanity Fair cover shoot in 1996. He's dressed in jeans, a tank top, holding a cowboy hat, and walks across a highway in desolate countryside. This article is from the book All Right, The Oral History of Richard Linklater's Dazed and Confused by Melissa Mayers. Copyright 2020 by Melissa Mayers. Reprinted by permission of Harper, an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers. One of the reasons people still love to watch Dazed and Confused is that it transports you back in time, not just to 1976, but also to 1992, when it was filmed. You can return to the days when Ben Affleck still had baby fat and Parker Posey still smacked her gum. We get older. They stay the same age. The cast is forever preserved on screen at a moment of infinite potential, one of the last moments before they'd have to start acting less like regular goofballs and more like movie stars. We went into the movie a bunch of kids, and we came out a lot more mature, says Jason London. It was the beginning of us becoming adults. No one felt that change more acutely than Matthew McConaughey. He was 23 years old when he filmed Dazed, and like his character, Wooderson, he was still mostly hanging out with younger people. He hadn't yet finished his undergraduate studies at the University of Texas, and he was still partying with his fraternity brothers. But he was only on set a few days when two things happened that forced him to grow up fast. First, his father died. Then he delivered the line that transformed him from a bit player into a leading man. Matthew McConaughey, I was about 4 or 5 days into shooting, and I got the call. Monty Wills, friend. Matthew was shooting nights, sleeping during the day. His mom tried to call us, and we didn't answer the phone because it was early. We might even have turned the ringers off. His girlfriend, Tony, came to the house and came to my room because she couldn't bring herself to tell Matthew what had happened. She was in tears. I could barely get it out of her. She said, I can't be the one to tell him. So I went down and said, Matthew, something's happened. You need to call your mom. Matthew McConaughey, my dad died making love to my mother, 6:30 on a Monday morning. My dad had always told me and my two brothers, boy, when I go, I'm going to be making love to your mother. And he did. Talk about a badass. The guy called his shot about how he was leaving this earth and did it. S.R. Bendler, friend, that's perfect, right? It's like Babe Ruth pointing the bat and telling people where he's going to hit the home run and then hitting it. Sam Lawrence, friend, Matthew called me the day his dad died. Dude, I need someone to hang out with. And we ended up at a strip club. By the way, if you ever want to feel completely invisible, go to a strip club with Matthew McConaughey. It was weird. He was talking about his dad, really emotional stuff. We're talking across the table, just looking at each other, and in the meantime, strippers are walking across the table. Monty Wills. Maybe the next day he called me and said, we're having a little thing. Do you want to come up to Houston? I said, of course. So I drove to Houston. It was a small, intimate gathering. Jason London, actor. He had one of those incredibly close families. I met his dad once, and Jim was like your typical John Wayne Texas cowboy, and his mother was lovely. You could tell that they were all madly in love with each other. And if the world ended, they would be out there on their compound and they would be the last to survive. I mean, they had effing tanks and shit. They had rocket launchers. I don't know why. For fun? Monty Wills. Everyone was telling stories about him. We were drinking a lot of Miller Lite and trying to be upbeat. Matthew McConaughey. We had an Irish wake. It was full on roasting the snot out of him. Jason David Scott, publicist. Later someone said, what was the service like? And Matthew said, well, my mom told the story about how my dad died. They were in the act of lovemaking. And apparently, his mom said, at the funeral, by the way, he did get to finish. Next photos, school days. Matthew McConaughey on the set of Dazed and Confused. Christine Harnos, Joey Lauren Adams, and Jason London. Ben Affleck, Cole Hauser, and Jason O. Smith. Fearsome senior girls Dina Martin, Michelle Burke, Adams, and Parker Posey. Rory Cochrane, London, and Sasha Jensen. McConaughey with director Richard Linklater, who was following up his debut movie Slacker. Mila Jovovich and Sean Andrews. Adams and Posey. Affleck abandons his plan to give somebody a paddling when he runs into the boy's no-nonsense mom. Monty Wills. The telephone book story made the rounds at the funeral. Matthew McConaughey. Dad was in the oil business, and he had a lot of people that owed him money. He had hired two guys to go collect for him. Well, one of them was like 6'4". His name was Big Ray, and he had dark shades, dark suit. And the other one was this little Asian guy, about 5'2". And what they evidently did was, Ray went over behind the desk of the person who owes Dad. Hey, I hear you owe Mr. McConaughey. We've been trying to collect this in a congenial manner. We've given you a few chances. Time's up. And he's like, yeah, it's coming. I'm getting it right now. See, we've been really patient with you, sir. And as they're having this creepy, quiet conversation with this man, Big Ray moves behind the desk, and the Asian guy's putting on a pair of black gloves. Big Ray grabs the Houston phone book, lifts the guy up, holds the guy's arms back, and holds the Houston phone book against his chest. Now the Asian guy lifts up a pistol. Well, the guy just fell to the ground, shit himself, crying, I'm paying, I'm paying. Goes to the safe, gives him the money, blah, blah, blah. Big Ray says, don't let it happen again. Or next time my man here won't just use a 22. Because a 22 will only make it to M in the Houston phone book. Isn't that great? Dad loved shady deals, man. He collected on that. But what was better than collecting the money was having that story. S.R. Bendler. Jim was a great storyteller, charming as hell. He had a twinkle in his eye, man. Matthew is a movie star and charms everybody he meets. But you put him next to Jim McConaughey, you're going to watch Jim McConaughey, you know? And Matthew would love to hear that. Matthew wasn't dwelling on the fact that he lost his father. It was, how can I honor my father? What are great stories I have from my father? What did my father teach me? Matthew McConaughey, I was trying to figure out what that means, when you lose a father. Monty Wills, I know Matthew was probably processing all that was happening, but there's no universe where K-Mac, his mom, is going to let those boys wallow in any kind of self-pity. S.R. Bendler, at Matthew's house, if we went out and spent the night there, it's 7 a.m., K-Mac storms into Matthew's bedroom, flings open the blinds and the drapes. Texas summer sun is ripping in. And she gets a big gallon pot of water with ice in it and would dump it on us. It's 7 a.m. You guys can't sleep all day. Get out of the bed. Monty Wills. Matthew told me if he got up in the morning and came down with a bad attitude, she'd send him back to his room and would literally say, get back in bed. Get out of bed. Try again. She did not let Matthew have any sense of, oh, you're a victim, you poor thing. It's like something's not going right. Go look in the mirror. That's the guy right there that can handle that for you. Matthew McConaughey, we had very simple rules in my house. You weren't allowed to say can't. You can say, I'm having trouble. I remember that lesson very clearly. It was a Saturday morning. I was supposed to mow the lawn. I was having trouble getting the lawnmower started. I went in and told my dad, I can't get the lawnmower started. And he'd hear that word, and you'd see his ears perk up, and you saw his jaw just start to kind of grind in his molars. And he slowly got up, walked out of the house, tried to start the lawnmower, didn't start. He took the thing apart, put some new gas, put a new spark plug, whatever, and about 45 minutes later, it started. He hadn't said a word this whole time. And then he looked at me. He goes, see, you were just having trouble. Monty Wills, I think Matthew would tell you the way his dad died is about as good as you could ask for. The logic of that made sense to Matthew, that his dad was a happy man and had no real regrets, and it wasn't tragic. And I think that nexus between being right in the middle of production and his father passing created some kind of energy in him. Matthew McConaughey, my family was like, you've got to go back. It was obvious to go back. What my dad taught us was resilience. No way was I going to be moping around and miss what I was in the middle of doing. Jason David Scott, Don Phillips, the casting director, had flown in for the funeral, and everybody was like, okay, he'll be gone for a couple of days. This was the beginning of the Emporium week, so it was like, we'll shoot around Matthew. He's not a major character. He doesn't have to be in every scene. Jason London, Matthew wasn't on set, so it was like, where's Matthew? And Rick takes me aside like, we're flipping the schedule around right now. We're trying to figure out what we're going to do. Matthew's father died, and we're like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. We look up, and Matthew's right there, and I'm like, are you sure his dad died? Jason David Scott, he was back the next day. I remember seeing a couple of people crying. Everyone's coming out saying, oh Matthew, I'm so sorry. Richard Linklater, writer, director, producer, I saw him walking up. I just ran over to him, and we talked for a while. I was just trying to gauge where he was at, but he was like, no, man, I'm good. Jason David Scott. That was the day he does. That's what I love about these high school girls, man. I get older. They stay the same age. Anthony Rapp, actor. I get older. They stay the same age? That's funny, but it's really effed up. Richard Linklater. It's meant to be harsh. Sasha's character, Don, says Wooderson should go to jail for saying that. Next photo, The Hustler. McConaughey has always been drawn to characters and people outside the mainstream. And in this photo, McConaughey shoots pool. Ben Affleck, actor. In light of the Me Too era, it's not an entirely appropriate thing to be quoting. It probably never was. I keep getting older and they stay the same age. That's R. Kelly's anthem. But to this day, people still quote that line to me, and I'm not even in the scene. That's a testament to Matthew's enormous charm. Matthew McConaughey, I mean, if we're going to sit here and do any kind of psychoanalysis or objective judgment, if you're going to try to break Wooderson down, you're already in a different narrative than he is. The everyday world, the manners and social graces, and the way life is supposed to go on and men are supposed to evolve. Yeah, he doesn't fit in that. He's on his own frequency. He is living in ignorance. Wooderson is not the kind of guy who's going to get conscious of like, oh, this is creepy. He's just the kind of guy that goes, I'm sorry you see it that way. Whatever's going on in your life, I hope you get through it. I love characters and people in life with great convictions that are outside of the mainstream. At least you see where they stand. At least they're not trying to placate and pander. You can trust Wooderson, man. He's right there in the open with you. There's nothing about him that I ever saw as creepy, which might be exactly why that's even creepier. But you can say that, not me. You know what I mean? In every script, you hopefully get at least one, what I call, a launchpad line. You go, okay, if I deconstruct the meaning of this, there's a book on this character. That line Rick wrote, you unpack that line. Who not only thinks that, but believes that? That's this guy's DNA. He has gotten to a place where he's like, I've out Peter Panned Peter Pan. I have got this figured out. I mean, he's not thinking ahead. Oh, this will be tougher in 10 years. No, 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 no. Wooderson steps forward to the curb and says that, like, to the world, to the ether. It's a mantra. It's a philosophy. He's pleased with his place and his coordinates in the universe. You could say he's delusionally optimistic. Valerie de Keyser, production assistant. The minute those words came out of his mouth, I swear to God, he immediately took us all. The cast, the crew, it was like, holy shit, who is that guy? Jason David Scott. Don Phillips turned to producer Jim Jacks and said, this is a movie star. It was weird, because he wasn't a big character. He wasn't even on my radar. John Cameron, first assistant director. He was just a guy, right? Just another one of the cast, and one of the lesser-known people. We had people who had already established a reputation, even in their youth, and Matthew just came in and blew everybody away. And it really elevated the film. It made it something, to me, beyond just funny. He brought a sense of sadness. Deb Pastor, set director. He was processing this deep, deep loss as he was doing his job. How could all of us not love this guy after experiencing that? And this was going to stay with him through all the successes he experienced. Matthew McConaughey. It was very cool that I had already started the film when my dad passed away. He got to be alive for what ended up being what I do with my career. There's grace in that for me. Monty Wills. After his dad died, a switch flipped for sure. You know, you hear these stories of like Bill Clinton meets John F. Kennedy when he's 16 years old and he decides, I'm going to be president one day. Or the moment that makes Tiger Woods decide, I'm going to be the best golfer. After his father passed, I think some sort of ambition clicked into Matthew. Like, life is short, and I'm going to do the things I'm good at, and I don't give an F what anybody else thinks. Billy's Blues. The feds hounded her because they feared her voice. Introducing The United States versus Billie Holiday by Johanna Desta. In the photo, Lady Day, Andra Day as Billie Holiday, and Trevante Rhodes as an undercover agent. Andra Day remembers being 11 years old and hearing Billie Holiday's music for the first time. I was like, what? This is nothing like Whitney Houston, she recalls with a laugh. It really transformed me as a singer. Now the Grammy-nominated artist is set to play Holiday in The United States versus Billie Holiday, directed by Lee Daniels, who also did Precious, and written by playwright and screenwriter Suzanne Laurie Parks. The drama, due out February 12th, delves into the Federal Bureau of Narcotics' quest to imprison Holiday on drug charges as retribution for her singing political songs like Strange Fruit and her dedication to integrating audiences. Day will be making her feature acting debut opposite Moonlight breakout Trevante Rhodes as Jimmy Fletcher, the undercover agent who switched allegiances after falling for the singer. Holiday's love of fur and fine jewels, as well as her lesser-known romances with women, will also figure in the film. Her life story is a foundational text for Daniels, not only because of her artistry, but because the filmmaker once battled drug addiction himself. He cast Day, a smoky soul singer whose voice has a natural Holiday-esque bent, in 2018 after being blown away by her audition. She wasn't acting, he says. She was just bearing her soul. Charlotte's Web by Mark Seal. Charlotte Kirk hoped some of Hollywood's most powerful men could help her become a movie star. But behind the scenes were text, sex, and secret financial deals, which led to the downfall of a studio chief and the industry's most powerful mogul. In the photos, they said, she said, ex-NBC Universal Vice Chairman Ron Meyer, shown in 2015, was known as LA's Mr. Fix-It. He and former Warner Brothers CEO Kevin Tsuchihara were knocked from their pedestals after encounters and disputes with actor Charlotte Kirk, photographed in 2018. Hard-boiled Hollywood mysteries usually start with a woman. This one was 19, with big eyes, blonde hair, and the ability to turn on the charm when she wanted something. And what Charlotte Sophie Kirk wanted more than anything was to be a movie star. It was 2012, and Kirk had just landed in New York City to network, as she told a friend, which is how she'd met the older man at her side. He wanted to help her with her career, so introduced her to a lawyer named Ray Markovich, who had produced a few low-budget movies. One look at Kirk, and Markovich wanted to get her work, too. "I needed someone for one scene," he says, and she said, "Great." "I tried to help. I just remember she had a lot of drive, and she was very prepared." "It's a Rolodex and a relationship business," he continues. "You can't make a living as an actor doing low-budget indies. You have to have a second job. I think she was doing some modeling. It's all about building, building, building." Markovich assisted in getting her cast in a film he was co-producing called Black Dog, Red Dog, organized by the actor James Franco, who was teaching at NYU. Kirk had only one line, and her tiny scene was cut from the film, but it gave her the opening she needed. "I will be in L.A. from tomorrow, so what do I need to do to be in SAG?" she emailed a producer on June 19, 2012. A Screen Actors Guild membership was the key to getting more roles and being taken seriously as an actor. The daughter of a television and video engineer, Kirk grew up in the suburbs of London. She was diagnosed with Asperger's at age 8. "I wasn't a natural academic and didn't enjoy school much," she would say. Then, at 11, she saw the movie that would change her life, Gone with the Wind, with its headstrong hero Scarlett O'Hara. "So after graduating from drama school, aged 19, I packed up and moved to the U.S. She arrived in New York City, armed with headshots and modeling photos, produced by yet another man eager to jumpstart her career. In addition to shooting her a portfolio gratis, the London photographer had built her a free website in hopes that she would go on to be famous and make the images worth publishing, he says today. "As you know, a beautiful picture is nice, but you've got to have a reason to publish the picture." Kirk soon had a reason, emailing the photographer dispatches from her exciting new life on the rise. She'd met some industry people at a party. She had been invited to Los Angeles. She was going to be a star. "She was more determined and ambitious than I realized at the time," he says. Before long, Kirk had amassed quite a collection of beaux as well. There was the billionaire Steve Tisch, scion of the New York Jets football family, and producer of movies including Forrest Gump, who had a relationship with Kirk shortly after her arrival in New York, according to The Hollywood Reporter. There was an even richer billionaire, the Australian casino magnate James Packer, who reportedly took up with Kirk in November 2012. And there was Kevin Tsuchihara, at the time the chairman and CEO of Warner Brothers Entertainment. He and Kirk crossed paths, briefly but fatefully, in 2013. Their collision exploded into view in March 2019 when someone released a trove of astonishingly explicit text messages indicating that, seemingly in exchange for sex, The studio executive had helped Kirk secure a small part in 2018's Ocean's 8, among other roles. Within days of the leak, Tsujihara, though he denied the allegations, was forced to resign from Warner Brothers. If that was a surprise, what came next was downright shocking. Tsujihara may have been a powerful executive in Hollywood, but NBC Universal Vice Chairman Ron Meyer was a living legend. On August 18, 2020, Meyer released a stunning statement. "I recently disclosed to my family and the company that I made a settlement under threat with a woman outside the company who had made false accusations against me. Admittedly, this is a woman I had a very brief and consensual affair with many years ago. I made this disclosure because other parties learned of the settlement and have continuously attempted to extort me into paying them money, or else they intended to falsely implicate NBC Universal, which had nothing to do with this matter, and to publish false allegations about me." It didn't take long for Hollywood sleuths to determine that the woman in question was none other than Charlotte Kirk. She and Meyer had met in London on May 4, 2012, at the after-party for the London premiere of Universal's Snow White and the Huntsman. As Charlize Theron, Kristen Stewart, and Chris Hemsworth mingled with the rest of the cast and crew, the all-powerful Meyer, 67, was introduced to the unknown Kirk, 19. "She said she was going to be in L.A. and asked if she could call him," says a source close to Meyer, while some say that he suggested she call him. Soon after, they had two liaisons in discreet locations in New York and L.A., careful never to be seen in a public place. Meyer was married, after all. Then, 8 years later, just like that, Meyer's quarter-century career at Universal was over in a flash. The most beloved member of a group who once owned Hollywood as much as anyone has ever owned anything, out in one phone call, wrote veteran Hollywood chronicler Richard Rushfield. To him, Meyer's sudden fall from grace was a genuine Hollywood mystery that seemed straight out of, well, a movie. At the center of the saga was Kirk, who shot overnight from obscurity to notoriety. Two more of Kirk's lovers, the British-born directors Joshua Newton and Neil Marshall, soon appeared in press accounts as having been accused of extortion, a charge they vehemently deny. As Marty Singer, Hollywood's fiercest attorney, sees it, she was a honey trap, his reference to wartime spies known to use sex to ensnare their targets. Although Kirk herself, due to a court order, is prohibited from commenting. To hear those around her tell it, she was nothing of the kind. Instead, she was one more woman drawn to the bright lights of Hollywood, only to be deceived, swindled, and abused. Indeed, this October, a group of demonstrators protested outside an L.A. courthouse, hoisting signs that said "Let Charlotte Speak," to draw attention to Kirk's case, turning her, in effect, into the latest face of hashtag MeToo. He got into the business, as they used to say in pictures, for the action. A Marine stricken with a case of the measles, Ronnie Meyer was alone in a military hospital when a care package arrived from his mother, Edith. She and her husband, Edward, were German Jews who escaped Nazi Germany in 1939, eventually settling in Los Angeles. Dad became a traveling salesman of ladies' dresses, a schlepper of bags, Meyer once said, and Mom, a guilt-free Jewish mother, as he recounted in a 2016 WSJ magazine story by Ned Zeman entitled "Hollywood's Mr. Nice Guy." The Meyers dreamed that their only son would go to college, earn a degree, and find a decent job. Instead, he dropped out of high school and became a minor league hoodlum with a couple of arrests for petty crimes. At 17, he signed up for a stint in the Marine Corps. Quarantined and going nowhere, he opened the care package from his mother. Amid the cards and cookies was a book, The Flesh Peddlers, a novel about a talent agency, by Stephen Longstreet. I had never really read a book at that point in my entire life, Meyer would later say. Alone in that empty hospital ward, the young Marine lost himself in the rollicking tale of COK, Company of Kings, a Beverly Hills talent agency where adultery, fornication, alcohol, gambling, gluttony, sport had to be fitted into a busy, demanding company life. It was about a guy in the agency business who drove a fast car and went out with beautiful women and lived what I thought of as a glamorous Hollywood life, Meyer would recall. I thought, wow, when I get out. Upon leaving the service, he went door to door to every talent agency in town, but got nowhere until a slim connection, my mother's best girlfriend's husband's sister, he told WSJ, scored him a grunt job at the Paul Koner agency. From there, the messenger boy with the Marine tattoo on his arm made a fast ascent. By age 25, he was an agent at William Morris, living his dream of big money, fast cars, and free love. One day, we saw Geneviève Bujol idling her Mercedes in the office parking lot, his fellow agent Michael Ovitz wrote in his 2018 memoir. Ron was obsessed with Geneviève, a Morris client and a very hot actress at the time. Ron walked over to introduce himself as one of her agents. He told her how great she was and said he'd like to get to know her better. Then he asked if he could buy her an ice cream cone someday. I saw Geneviève nod and smile. They had a date. Ron's invite was so innocuous it worked. In 1975, Meyer and four other young renegades, including Ovitz, decamped to found the powerhouse agency of the future, which would fuel movies, television, sports, and music for decades to come. They called it Creative Artist Agency, but like the Company of Kings, it became known by its initials, CAA. Then and now, CAA was a star factory, packaging its clients in projects that the agency controlled. Its clients, Redford, Hanks, Murray, Hoffman, Bullock, became superstars, and its agents became power brokers, with Ovitz and Meyer at the top. Meyer the good cop, Ovitz the bad. As Ovitz would later write, Ron was the soul of CAA, to hear everyone tell it, and I was the ass soul. Meyer was conciliar, confidant, and champion of the era's biggest directors, screenwriters, and actors. Cruise, Stallone, Streisand, Streep, Cher, De Niro. In the mid-1990s, Ovitz and Meyer planned another power move. They would decamp from CAA to become the bosses at Universal. The studio conglomerate, Seagram CEO Edgar Bronfman Jr., had just bought for $5.7 billion. Ovitz would run the company and Meyer the studio. A financial disagreement between Ovitz and Bronfman almost doomed the deal until DreamWorks co-founder David Geffen stepped in to advise Bronfman that there was only one genius who could run it all, Ronnie Meyer. As COO, Meyer soon turned Universal into a juggernaut. Hit movies, bustling theme parks, and profits, 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 and remained in power for 18 years, a record tenure for a modern-era studio boss. In 2013, he stepped down, but not out, into a hands-on advisory role, becoming Universal's vice chairman as the studio pumped out hit movie franchises like 50 Shades of Grey, and licensed the Harry Potter novels and other attractions, catapulting Universal's theme parks in Los Angeles, Orlando, Japan, and Singapore to success. Now 75, and reportedly earning as much as $25 million a year, Meyer had become the old guy in the company, as he once put it. But As recounted in the WSJ profile, he still worked as fiendishly as ever from his office in Universal City, where, with three assistants, he began fielding his usual 100 calls a day. Days, nights, weekends, Meyer was always on call. We had a major fire on the back lot, destroyed the film vault, and he jumped in his own car and drove over late at night, says former Universal executive Mike Sington. I saw him on site directing what was going on with the firefighters. Nice guy Ronnie had long ago traded power suits for cardigans, jet black instead of Mr. Rogers red. He was the calming, cheerleading Aminatskis who urged The Rock to move from professional wrestling to acting in the 2001 Universal film The Mummy Returns, and gave Angelina Jolie her shot as a first-time director on a major Hollywood film, Unbroken, in 2014. Here's the deal. In order to be successful in Hollywood, you don't need to be an asshole, he told WSJ, after signing a contract extension that would keep him on through 2021. Next photos, Kirk and company. Shujihara, Kirk and director Joshua Newton, a former boyfriend. Hollywood legal heavyweight Marty Singer. Kirk and fiancé Neil Marshall, the British screenwriter-director. With more than 50 years in the business and with a world of connections, he had become one in a very small group of moguls who could put out fires and get things done. Ronnie is the fixer, says longtime journalist and Deadline Hollywood founder Nikki Fink, who came out of retirement to speak about Meyer for this article. It wasn't just at CAA or Universal. If Warner Brothers or another agency was having trouble, they would get Ron to fix it. He is a rarity in a town where everybody loves to pretend that they're so effing important, and they don't have time for people or problems, says Fink. People knew they could call him at 3 a.m. on a Sunday, and he would immediately have a solution. If somebody was threatening to sue, if somebody was messing up a movie or a TV show, if an executive was in trouble, he fixed it. And yet the man whom one friend describes as a piece of solid steel also had another career, which was not so nice, as a high-stakes gambler. Over time, he became a member of the most rarefied category of gambler, a whale, among the top in the nation. In his memoir, Ovitz wrote, "One morning in 1987, Ron came into my office, shut the door, and said, 'I've got a problem.' He'd lost $5 million in a poker game and said, 'I can't pay up.' Several days after work each week, he'd fly to Vegas, where he would gamble all night, then return to L.A. in the morning and work his ass off as usual." Ovitz wrote that he was floored by the revelation, but CAA loaned Meyer $1 million, only to have him return a year and a half later with an even bigger loss, $6.5 million. "I felt like he'd smashed me with a baseball bat," Ovitz wrote. "Who was this man?" At one point, Meyer was in the hole for several million, and not to Hollywood card sharks like those his former son-in-law, Toby Maguire, gambled with. This wasn't some casino on the Strip, the journalist James Andrew Miller wrote in Powerhouse, an oral history of CAA. The guys Meyer was on the hook to only swam in the deep end of the pool. Forever an agent, Meyer negotiated with his creditors, which enabled him to leave that meeting alive, both legs operative, genitalia intact, according to Powerhouse. But the gambling only grew until he was one of the biggest craps players ever, a source recently told the Daily Mail. Casino player development executives reportedly baited him with credit and kept him at the tables with perks like helicopter flights to private gambling palaces, until he had racked up almost unfathomable losses. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.